Blog Talk Radio.
Let me tell you about something new. A new show called G's Power.
G's Power.
Real talk for real saints.
Are you ready?
And it's for real.
Welcome to G's Power Hour, live every weekday at 11:30 a.m. on Never Had It So Good Entertainment Network. Your host, G, will bring you informative and entertaining guests and a variety of topics in a way that you can absorb and enjoy. Listen in weekdays and call in at 516-387-1944. We love interaction. All shows can be downloaded if you miss one or found on iTunes the next day. G's Power Hour is powered by Never Had It So Good Sports Media Network.
All right. Good morning, brothers and sisters, kings and queens, angels and saints, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. I am your host, G. Thanks so much for being with us today. I'm not talking much today because we're rocking and rolling. This is the Chauvin trial update, and we're going to talk about some other things. And we have a medical forensics expert that's going to be on today to give us a little bit more insight in terms of asphyxiation and other factors that are involved in this trial. But to give us the latest and greatest about what's going on with the Derek Chauvin trial and other things in the great state of Minnesota, specifically Minneapolis, I'm going to talk to Anderson & Welch attorney Kevin Anderson. Good morning, sir.
Hey, good morning, and happy Tuesday to you. Glad to be here.
Happy Tuesday. So go.
Wow. Things are on and popping.
Yeah.
You know, it just caught me by surprise that we would be dealing with yet another shooting in Minnesota in the same county as the trial that is taking place for Derek Chauvin. You know, I'm watching that develop. The whole world is watching the facts develop and, you know, trying to hang on as I'm hearing some of the police liability experts describe how they're feeling and reacting. You know, we'll get more information on that particular situation as things develop in the near future. With respect to the Derek Chauvin trial, things shifted pretty quickly from training and use of force to now medical causation for Mr. Floyd's death. The state seemed to have piled on quite a bit with respect to what some people would call cumulative evidence of use of force experts who were able to give an opinion as to the necessity and reasonableness of the force that was applied to Mr. Floyd. And uniformly, these experts stated that, A, the force was unnecessary, and to the extent that it may have been authorized at some point, that the force carried on for way too long, which then went into a medical distress mode for Mr. Floyd, which, of course, now is something that we're dealing with as a homicide. I'm so glad that we have our forensic specialist who's here today to delve into what the trial now has begun to present as a causation quagmire. I watched on Thursday, I watched Friday, I watched yesterday, which was Monday, all of the witnesses come in from the lung and critical care specialist to the medical examiner to the pathologist who is a consultant to the emergency medical physician from the other agency that was brought in, and also the cardiologist who brought up the rear, so to speak. And, man, I'm not going to steal thunder, man. I'm just going to sit back here and let our forensic specialist kind of take it away. And, you know, I'll chime in here and there. But for the most part, man, we're into the meds.
Yeah, no pressure, right, Kevin? No, that's, I've been watching it too, and I think, you know, I think some of the experts have done a really good job in, you know, both the test, like the testimony itself, but also in providing what they were, you know, there to provide, which, you know, as prosecution experts, they're trying to provide the facts, you know, on behalf of the prosecution. But then they also need to provide a very fair and unbiased opinion, you know, during cross-examination, and some of them did better than others.
No, I'm just saying, because I know you're going to take this football and run with it, but we need to know who you are.
Yes, I forgot about that part. My name is Tara Godoy. I'm a forensic nurse, and I consult and testify on criminal cases with an area of specialty in strangulation, and which also then includes suffocation and asphyxiation. So that's my kind of my interest in this case is, of course, the relevance to my area of specialty.
Yeah, see, I knew she was chomping at the bit there, but she really got out the gate before I could.
I'm sorry.
No, don't apologize, please. Okay, now we can continue to go.
Well, I was just going to say, I thought that Dr. Tobin, who was the pulmonologist, really provided a lot of good information and educated the jury really well on just the mechanics of breathing and the requirements of the body that, you know, in its need for oxygen to survive. And so in that sense, I thought that he was a really good expert and an unbiased expert able to provide information for both sides.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about your field specifically before we get more into the trial. I want to know what, you know, apparently you know your business. When do they call you in? And when do you know that they're going to call you in on some stuff?
Yeah, so, you know, every forensic expert has a different role. There's a lot of forensic experts that work pre-arrest. So there's people that work out in the field and gather the evidence and do the investigation, and then there's other experts that are like me that come in after the person has been arrested and now they're trying to develop the case and get ready for trial. So what happens is when somebody gets arrested and they're you know, case is coming up for trial, then the attorney will contact me and my colleagues to consult on the case and determine whether or not our opinions are favorable to whichever side is calling us. And as a strangulation expert, I've testified for both the prosecution and the defense and provided, you know, consultation on both sides. And then once we get to the point of trial, then, you know, obviously you go and testify. So, but we get brought in usually, you know, early on in the sense of the, you know, trial phase, but it's usually long after the person has been arrested.
Okay, so my big question in all of this right now with the death of George Floyd is asphyxiation in terms of how to determine whether it's something that was caused by the drugs or caused by the knee on the neck or both. And my simple question also with regards to this is, if he had just been walking with the drugs in his system, if he had just been walking around doing his normal daily whatever thing that he does, would he have died from just the drugs in his system?
Highly unlikely. With the amount of drugs in his system and his history of drug use, there's not a lot of chance that he would have just, you know, keeled over at that point. And as many of the experts testified, is the type of death when you're talking about a drug overdose and a specifically narcotic overdose is it's very slow. You know, you get tired, you get sleepy, you pass out, and then even after that period of time, you're still alive for a period of time before your breath finally stops. It's like you're kind of just dwindling down to nothing, and it's not something where you just keel over from overdose, not on narcotics.
Okay. So, you know, the fact that, let's say, they say he was, napping in the car, could that have been part of what was going on with him? Just curious.
Yeah, I mean, if he was napping in the car, it's definitely a possibility that he was feeling the effects of the medications. But that doesn't necessarily lend to an overdose level for him. You know, mm-hmm. The medications are going to have the side effects of making him sleepy, but that doesn't necessarily mean that he's going to go down the path of respiratory arrest, stopping breathing.
Okay. All right. So let me ask you, we talked a little bit about this in our call before. Are public expectations unrealistic with regards to what they expect to come out of this trial and out of expert witness testimony and everything? Are they unrealistic by virtue of the fact that so many people watch these television crime shows now?
Yeah, well, that's one of the things I'm really liking about this is the public access to being able to watch the full trial. And I know that probably the majority of people are not watching it day-to-day as some of us are, and that are, you know, I think Kevin mentioned that he's watching most of it as well, and I'm pretty much caught up. I've watched almost every day in its entirety. But, yes, I think what happens is the TV shows make everything look like it's going to happen in an hour, and then the other thing that I think that the TV shows and the media misleads people to believe is that there's a lot of, you know, drama that occurs on the stand, that, you know, people are slamming their hands down and being aggressive in cross-examination and, you know, doing little tricky things to get people to say things. And that's not reality. So, you know, the reality is that there's a lot at stake on the stand in the courtroom. And so both the attorneys and the experts are going to be cautious about what they're offering, and there's rules that are, you know, that are in place to protect that, to make sure that there isn't really any grandstanding.
So you said that you've been watching the trial, and I'm sure you've seen the video, and you've probably re-examined it on your own time a few times. You know, we all have, I think, first it was 8 minutes and 48 seconds, and now it's 9 minutes, 29 seconds, or whatever. We all have an idea in terms of this going on for, I guess if you want to round it up, almost 10 minutes where this man was dying right in front of just about everybody. As you look at the video, if you were there, how soon would you have called, I guess, his death, you know, on an expert level, and how many minutes exceeded that? When did you see in your eyes that man is gone?
Yeah, that's something else that they did pretty well in the trial of identifying when he stopped breathing. And so, you know, there was a point in time where he had what's called agonal respirations, and I think they testified on that subject as well, where it almost looks like he's gasping for air, like, you know, like a fish out of water, where he's gasping for air, and those are agonal respirations, and those indicate the time that he was very, very close to death. And so then, and that's, you know, they are associated with the immediate following of death. And so that's when, you know, essentially he stopped breathing, and within a very short period of time after that, he would have had, you know, complete heart and cardiopulmonary arrest.
It's just hard. So I guess, so when we look at the physical, if you had to do, let's say, percentages, if we look at the cause of death, how much of it was physical and how much of it was drug-related, if you had to break it down into, for simplification, a pie chart, what percentages of what happened contributed George Floyd's death?
Wow, that's a tough one. Partly also is you're not including all the pieces of the pie. There were so many contributing factors included here. So one of the things is that, you know, so of course he does have the underlying heart condition. He has the drugs on board. He has, he had just had a panic attack. Essentially he was, you know, when they were trying to get him into the police car, he was having a panic attack. He's also, you know, being arrested, and so he's got adrenaline. And so there's a lot of insults onto his system even before we take into account the compression onto the chest and the neck. So, you know, before we even get to that part, we've got an increase in demand, which they haven't done a lot of talking about in the trial, in my opinion, of the different things that are putting an increase in demand on his already taxed system, and then mm-hmm. on top of that, we're adding, you know, that we're decreasing the supply. So what happens is with the increase in adrenaline and, you know, he's hyperventilating during the just prior to the detainment, you know, where they're trying to get him in the car. And so all of that, he's not – when you hyperventilate, you don't even though you're breathing faster, you're not getting the oxygen that you need because you're breathing so fast the body can't grab that oxygen and bring it into the body. And it can't offload, you know, the toxic gas that needs to be offloaded as well. And so the exchange is not happening efficiently. So you've got a decrease in oxygen already, and it's something that he could recover from, but, you know, he may not have had the opportunity to really recover from that prior to then being put on the ground and the compression on his chest, which then decreased his ability to breathe further. And then to take into the heart condition, I think that, you know, the defense has a valid argument there. I don't think that it caused his death, but I think that there was contributing factors. The fentanyl, you know, the methamphetamine, the heart condition, all those are contributing factors. But I still go back to, you know, if he was just walking around, you know, none of that would have caused his death. So I'll be interested to see how the defense makes their argument that he just simply died of a heart attack. I think that's what they're going to go for this week.
Yeah, I think that's going to I think that's going to be hard, in my opinion. But I may be a little biased, so I'm just going to leave that there. Now there have been other high profile asphyxiations. Related deaths, and I'm trying to think, and I know Kevin can probably help me. There's a gentleman. Well, okay, let's talk about that. I'll let you take that.
Well, yeah, so Eric Garner was a gentleman in New York City that was also restrained by the police department, and he was put into a headlock, you know, with the arm, you know, the carotid restraint essentially from the police and taken down to the ground. And I use that in my training mostly because it really exemplifies a lot of the misconceptions about strangulation and suffocation, how much strength it takes, how long it takes. And it, honestly, his circumstances were very different because there was obvious compression on both sides of his neck. What makes the Floyd case unique is that we had one-sided compression on the neck, and so there's only a partial occlusion of the, you know, the vessels in on the side of his neck. And he, as they said in the testimony, he still had the other side of blood flow. And so he, you know, even though he was partially occluded, he still had blood flow going to his brain, which is going to extend the amount of time it takes for somebody to be rendered unconscious.
I'm just kind of curious in terms of what do you think is going to be the impact of these type of cases when it comes to, I guess you could say, adjusting police training?
Well, I can only say that I hope that there will be an impact. I think that there's, you know, a lot of training that goes out to the police departments about neck restraints, and I think just given the amount of phone calls that I get on a regular basis from educated people, attorneys, investigators, and there's so many misunderstandings about carotid restraints and how lethal they are. And the bottom line is if you occlude the carotid artery on both sides of the neck, you can render somebody unconscious in 5 to 10 seconds, and you can kill them in a minute to 2 minutes. And so there's a very, you know, that's a very short window of time for these police officers to let go, especially in a high adrenaline situation. I think that there needs to be more awareness as to the risk of lethality when it comes to carotid restraints and their use in, you know, in police arrests.
I keep hearing this excuse, though, about, well, you know, he was a big guy. He was bigger than me, and the weight and height difference and everything, and the, I guess, using that as an excuse to having to use this technique. And, you know, I'm a little bit biased, I guess, and everything. But how much of a factor should that play in determining whether or not this is a tool that should be kept or adjusted or whatever in the arrest of, you know, suspects?
Well, I think it's an outcome of the, you know, the lethal force issue. And this is kind of going outside of my realm, but I think that, you know, when there's so much push to move away from from lethal force, then we're trying to find other mechanisms by which to subdue somebody that potentially is bigger than the police officer. And this, you know, this is definitely one way to do that, because you do not have to be bigger or stronger than somebody to knock them unconscious by using a carotid restraint.
Right. That's what I was thinking. Kevin, you want to comment on this? Did he leave us? Okay. I guess he left us. He's probably watching some more. Okay. Kevin?
Okay, so Tara, aren't there two carotid arteries in the neck?
Yeah, there's one on both sides, and the jugular vein as well. There's one on both sides.
Okay, so let's say hypothetically if you block or restrict the flow in one carotid artery, can you not exist and move forward with the flow being unobstructed on the other side?
Oh, no, you absolutely can. But one of the things to keep in mind, like, so let's take a pathological situation where somebody has a hardening of those arteries and it happens over time. The body's mm-hmm. going to get used to that decrease in flow, and it's going to compensate using the other side. But it's going to happen over time. The body gets a chance to get used to that. Whereas if you're in a traumatic situation where you're suddenly occluding the carotid artery on one side, then the body's still going to compensate, but it has to compensate much faster, and it's not going to have the ability to do it as well as if, you know, it knew it was kind of as if it knew it was coming. So, you know, if you hold one side of the carotid artery, you know, you can hold it indefinitely and you're not likely to even pass out. You might feel slight symptoms of hypoxia, which is low blood oxygen. But, you know, you're absolutely correct. As if it was just that, there probably wouldn't have been an issue. But what happened in this case is we also had obstruction of the ability of the lungs to expand and collapse. And mm-hmm. and again, we're also dealing with a supply versus demand thing. And so, like I said, everything, I think even if we had taken away some of the other underlying issues where we were only, you know, obstructing him in the prone position, the way he was being held, there's a possibility that there's a possibility he could have survived. But given the amount of time, that was really also a big issue, is, you know, just obstructing his lungs from expanding and collapsing, just obstructing one side of the neck by itself over a short period of time wouldn't have been an issue. But, it's the amount of time, and then, again, going back to the supply versus the demand.
And then also, I'm sorry, Kevin, I wanted to ask this. With that restriction, wouldn't that reduce oxygen to the brain cells and cause maybe some malfunctioning in the brain in terms of, okay, I'm in this position, how do I handle this? Because some of it is going to require thought, and some of it is going to require, I guess, maybe some reflex in order to try to figure out how to get out of that situation, or if there's a way out of that situation.
Yeah.
But with the restricted oxygen, isn't that going to cause some malfunctioning in the brain where the person's not going to be able to think clearly?
Yeah, absolutely. So what you're talking about is hypoxia, which is low blood oxygen, and specifically hypoxia in the brain. And anything that your brain does can be affected and malfunction as a result of not having enough oxygen. And one of those brain functions can be, you know, the mental acuity, the ability to think clearly, to make decisions, you know, all of that. So confusion and delirium are absolutely indications of low blood oxygen in the brain.
Okay. I'm sorry, Kevin. Go ahead. I just wanted to ask.
You know, the medical examiner stated that the cause of death was cardiopulmonary arrest. And you're, you know, talking about the defense attorney likely stating that a heart attack occurred. What is the difference between both of those medical definitions?
It's funny that you ask. I've been, you know, I've been talking to the nurses that I work with, and this is one of the things that has come up in the conversation is we feel that the, or at least I feel that the terms are not really being well defined for the jury. And, you know, heart attack is a layman's term, and from a medical perspective, a heart attack is a myocardial infarction. So that's where there's actually, you know, the heart muscle itself is not working and it's dying, the tissues of the heart, and that leads to cardiopulmonary arrest. Everybody across the world, 100%, everybody dies of cardiopulmonary arrest, but not everybody dies of a heart attack. And that's where we're seeing the difference is that, you know, essentially cardiopulmonary arrest is the medical term for death. Heart attack is one way that a heart attack or a myocardial infarction results in cardiopulmonary arrest, but it is reversible, you know, so if and not every heart attack even results in cardiopulmonary arrest. People can have a heart attack without ever having their heart stop beating or them to stop breathing. So there's different severities there as well. But I love that you asked that question because it's something that we really feel, I really feel has not been well defined for the jury. I understand, Kevin, and maybe you can confirm this, that there's a nurse on the jury.
There is a nurse on the jury, and I thought for a moment that that was going to work to the defense's advantage. I now am of the belief that it will work to their disadvantage. This week has been devastating. That nurse is going to take this information that has been testified to and presented through evidence, and, man, unless the defense comes back with a miracle, I just simply can't see good things happening for Mr. Chauvin.
Yeah, do you know that nurse's background at all? Do you know what kind of nursing cheer he does?
I don't. During jury selection, actually, I had everyone categorized, but I don't have at my fingertips exactly the nurse's background.
I was just curious. Okay. But I agree with you that there's that the defense really has a long walk ahead of them to try and come back from some of this. I do think that he made some good points during cross-examination this last week, but I also think we need to keep in mind that this is, you know, we've concluded the prosecution's case, and so the defense now gets their turn, and maybe, you know, who knows what he'll come up with. I do know that I understand that he has some of his own experts that he's calling, so it'll be interesting to see what they say.
Well, what type of medical evidence?
By the way, they say she's a cardiac nurse.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good. You know, that she's going to have a lot of understanding. And yeah, I'm with you then, Kevin. I think that the defense will have a hard time convincing her of their case. It, you know, that a cardiac nurse is going to have a really strong knowledge of what exactly happened.
Absolutely. Yeah, and an allegiance probably towards for the cardiologist and the other medical practitioners, and a respect for their testimony. So,
right.
With that in mind, what type of medical evidence does the defense have to present to refute or rebut the strong medical evidence so far that we've heard?
You know, I think that that's I mean. He basically has to get somebody to get up there and say the opposite, that, you know, that there, he has to get somebody that's going to be willing to get up there and say that, that the fentanyl levels were such a level and the methamphetamine levels were such a level that he could have died of, you know, sudden cardiac arrest. And that, you know, the only thing I can think of is that you can't, you know, you weren't looking at his heart at the time that he died. You know, and that's the only thing that I can come up with. I'm fascinated to see what he's going to bring. He's got a lot to bring to be able to dispute it. That's the bottom line.
Okay, we are going to take a quick break because I know Miss Tara has just been going on and on, and she probably needs to get her glass of water, and we're not done with her yet. So we're here talking about the Chauvin case and some other high-profile cases that asphyxiation may have played a role in. And we're also here with Kevin Anderson of Anderson & Welch. This is Dee's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. If you have questions, the number is 516-387-1944. Dee's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Network. We'll be right back.
Over the past 60 years, Dove Beauty Bar's superior formula has remained unchanged. But when it comes to beauty, everything changed. Together, we redefined beauty. We said no to stereotypes and yes to every type. We let go of judgments and embraced what makes us unique. We're proud to have been there with you, caring for you every step of the way. Here's to the next 60 years.
Having a wedding, reception, family reunion, planning a banquet, or some other fundraising event. Need to share your knowledge through a workshop or seminar, or it's a difficult time and you need to plan a wake or repast. Let us help. At our gatherings, let us reduce the stress and make the occasion memorable, treasured. Call our gatherings at 407-968-9387 or email ourgatherings@yahoo.com. Let us help plan your special event.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome back to G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. I am your host, G. Thanks so much for being with us today. We are getting an update on the Chauvin trial, and we're also getting some, a little bit more medical insight. We're here with medical forensic expert Tara Godoy, as well as civil rights attorney Kevin Anderson of Anderson & Welch. So, but before we go there, I know, Kevin, that you've been kind of watching this, and you and I have kind of been debating back and forth in terms of how long the trial is going to last, and you were saying you thought it was going to be several more weeks, and I was kind of thinking, I think this thing is going to wrap up pretty quickly. What are your thoughts now?
Well, we've been going for 3 weeks, and it's estimated, or at least stated by the trial court, that they anticipated the defense to wrap their case in chief up by the close of next week. That is doubtful. That is doubtful. And I've always been pretty critical of the trial process that gives the state unlimited time and a number of witnesses, even if the testimony is cumulative, to prove their case. But when it comes to the defense, which is a much, much higher slope or steeper slope to climb, the defense is given a limited time frame within which to rebut evidence that sometimes is just devastating. So, in terms of a time frame, I'm sticking to 5 weeks. I'm thinking that we're probably going to conclude things and have the case presented to the jury in week number 5, and deliberations will commence. So I kind of don't believe that the defense is going to close things up in, this limited period of time. And keep in mind also that there is a rebuttal case that is presented after the defense rests. So that rebuttal case will be opened by the state so that they can challenge some of the theories presented by the defense during their case in chief. And, there's cross-examination, there are going to be other motions that will be argued, et cetera. So I think we're in for a little bit more of a time frame here with respect to the presentation of evidence. The trial process itself carries with it jury instructions and arguments about those instructions, and then, of course, the closing arguments themselves. I think we're looking at a little bit more time on our hands.
Okay. And I know you and I have also talked a little bit about the jury. Do you have, so far from what you've seen, are you seeing any issues with the jury? I know we had concerns about them not being sequestered and whatnot. And I guess my other concern is what happened recently with regards to Dante Wright.
that's a problem. I started out saying that I disagreed with the trial court's decision not to sequester to those jurors, and I'm sticking to it. I think that this is a even greater reason to sequester the jurors, because now you've got this social pushback because of an event that has happened in the very same county where this trial of the decade is taking place. These jurors are affected, and they're going back to their homes. They're going back to a community that is inflamed. You know, the passions of these people, I think, will impact the jurors as they're trying to make a decision to be objective about the evidence that they're listening to. But they understand that the decisions are going to be scrutinized by people around them. In addition, they are going to tune into the airwaves, and they're going to listen to a comparison, not, you know, a shooting for a shooting, but use of force and reasonableness of force against another black person in the community by the police. This is a problem, and I think the jurors need to be taken from that pressure cooker and put in a sterile environment or reasonably isolated environment so that they can focus on the task at hand.
Yeah, because, like, how do you go home and you know how to read your family, you know how to read your friends. It's like, what's wrong? Nothing. I can't tell you. and it's obviously something that's bothering you, and, you know, this whole thing going on in our city again, and, like, oh, you know, everything's fine. No. You can't help but have some sort of influence whether or not your loved ones want to influence you or not. And, you know, there's always going to be that, okay, I need to do my own digging. I'm curious. I got to find out what's going on. Why are things so off, you know?
I was surprised by that too, Kevin. Is that something that they determine in the pretrial motions? And was that something that you were able to listen in on as to what the motions were and why they decided to allow the jurors to go home?
I listened to all of the pretrial motions and read them as they were filed and the orders pertaining to the motions. The order that sequestered the jurors was kind of unilaterally done. That was a trial procedures order that took place like in December before the trial even began in order to facilitate jury management. And typically you'll see the sequestration of a jury where there are concerns about the compromise of the integrity of the panel, safety reasons. Sometimes you will try to get a juror who is not going to be affected by pressure as they're, you know, traveling back and forth to the courthouse. So I believe there was an instance where one of the jurors was concerned about her identification being compromised as her badge or something was seen by one of the courtroom security personnel as she was a courthouse security personnel as she was entering. And I think we've also had a Swartz hearing, which is Minnesota's version of the juror misconduct inquiry so far in the case. But now, Tara, there was a motion by Attorney Nelson, the defense counsel, to question the jurors following the Wright killing over the weekend. And the trial court denied that motion yesterday and indicated that, listen, you know, sometimes we can highlight a problem that really isn't a problem, so let's move forward unless we have a problem. But that is probably going to be an appellate issue if Derek Chauvin is convicted. With respect to the jurors' influence because of this event, which has happened so close to the trial that's taking place.
Yeah, that's interesting that they're, you know, he's not even being allowed to ask the jury if they've heard about it, I guess. Is that what that means, that they're not even bringing
Absolutely.
It up? Wow.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, yeah. If you're that judge, you want to give the defense everything they're asking for. You want to take away every avenue to appeal, every avenue for post-conviction relief, so that you minimize the chance of this case coming back and being retried.
Yeah. Huh.
So, Tara, let me ask you this. You have, let's say you have two medical experts that are equally trained. What would cause one to, I guess, lean one way versus one to lean another way with you know, all of the facts right there?
That's a, you know, it's, it, that's really, you know, kind of the dilemma, right? It's you have two people that have the same background, and that's when the battle of the experts really comes to play. And a lot of it has to do with the facts that are provided to them. Now, you got to remember, as an expert, we have a narrow window of the case. We don't, you know, we're not, they, you know, they talked about thousands and thousands of pages of discovery in this case. The experts aren't going to review all of that discovery. They're going to review only the discovery that pertains to their opinion. And then you also have, you know, the influence of the attorney that's hiring them and, you know, hey, is this possible? Is this possible? Is that possible? And so those questions can be asked on direct or cross-examination, but it's whether or not the attorney that's doing the cross-examination is brave enough essentially to ask the same question of, you know, of that expert as they asked of their own expert, because you don't know how that expert's going to answer. So a lot of times it's you know, not, it's not that they have a difference of opinion. It's, you know, how the questions are asked and how they're posed to them.
Okay. All right.
Well, in Florida, we have the luxury of depositions in criminal cases. That is not the case in most jurisdictions. Most
three states.
They do not permit you the ability to examine the witness pre-trial under oath for purposes of trial preparation and potentially impeachment, and to give you discovery, which might lead to other usable evidence for your client. Florida is so liberal. You know, we're sitting there. We would have deposed every witness in this case. We would have a transcript. We would know exactly what that witness would be testifying to before the trial commenced. In this particular case, as it is being testified, that is the time when Mr. Nelson is getting the last glimpse of that witness's testimony, respectively.
Yeah, a lot of it is guesswork before that, you know, and I'm sure that Mr. Nelson has spoken to his own experts and, you know, prepared for the cross-examination, you know, using their information that they're providing, but you still don't know exactly what those experts are going to say.
Right.
Sure.
So let me ask you, Tara, if, you know, you saw the video and there were calls for, you know, he needs help, get him some help. You know, can you check his pulse, all of that. There was some question in terms of whether or not even checking his pulse with what was going on with the knee on the neck would have even made any sense. Can you talk about what would have and would not have helped had George Floyd been gotten some medical attention earlier?
Oh, well, there's definitely a time-sensitive issue here. It's that, you know, just because he was in cardiac arrest doesn't mean that he wasn't able to be resuscitated if they had started those resuscitative measures earlier. You know, the arrhythmias that he was in were not good arrhythmias, but there's the possibility that had they checked for a pulse prior to that and had they started CPR and started that blood flow and getting the oxygen back into the brain, that, you know, he may not have gone into that particular arrhythmia, the PEA. And so, you know, he might have been in, you know, another arrhythmia that's much easier to convert back to normal sinus, which is the normal heartbeat of the heart. And again, it's very time sensitive. And so checking the pulse and monitoring whether or not his heart is still beating would have allowed for, I mean, they had a CPR trained, well, they were all CPR trained, but they also had a firefighter right there that would have jumped in, and they could have started resuscitative measures almost immediately. And that very well could have made a difference.
Yeah, because I'm thinking also, too, there's no possible way, in my lay opinion, that had even
5 minutes before, maybe, I'm thinking, had Derek Chauvin taken his knee off of George Floyd, I don't think George Floyd was about to hop up and run away. So, you know, I mean, there could have been time to put him in maybe some sort of, in my opinion, some sort of maybe medical restraint or something, and maybe kept him sedated or something while transporting him to a hospital. Would that have been a possibility?
Yeah, I mean, we have the ambulances have restraints that they can put the patients in that are combative to protect really the people in the ambulance, the personnel. And, you know, depending on the circumstances, there are, medications that can be given, but that's all by protocol. And so every protocol is different. There's, you know, every ambulance in every city has different rules that they have to follow.
What was riveting to me was Dr. Martin Tobin's testimony, the pulmonologist, when he stated that, you know, after looking at the video, for 3 minutes and 2 seconds, after Floyd reached a point where there was no oxygen, that this was in his opinion, left in the body, the knee remained on George Floyd's neck. And then, after no pulse was found, that the knee stayed on Mr. Floyd's neck for an additional 2 minutes and 44 seconds. It sounds to me he was a goner before he was even put on the gurney.
Yeah. I mean, he was not moving for and not breathing for basically the 4 or 5 minutes, however long it was that he documented, or that the doctor, that Dr. Tobin indicated that he was not breathing. That's like a year. I mean, it's just so long in terms of being able to resuscitate people. The other one that's interesting to me is that the ambulance crew came in and moved him to another site instead of going straight to the hospital. And I think that also, you know, is a factor that should be considered in terms of the resuscitation, is that they delayed resuscitation, you know, essentially because they pulled over. They could have gotten him to the hospital where they had more invasive, maneuvers that they could have made there.
Yeah, we had spoken about that technique being what's known as a load and go, in order to pick up a person, to take them out of a caustic environment in order to conduct medical procedures. But you're saying that they should have just bypassed the sideline and headed directly to the emergency room.
Right. Well, and the load and go is just getting them out of the scene. At least in our area here, and I've spoken to a couple other people that have pre-hospital care experience, and all of us know load and go is you get the patient in the ambulance and you go straight to the hospital. This stopping on the side of the road and waiting for additional assistance is just not something that is done very often, and I don't know if that's part of their protocol, but it's unusual to say the least. And the other interesting factor is some protocols you don't leave the scene if the patient is in cardiac arrest. You resuscitate them there. You do, full CPR, all of your invasive medicine. You don't even put them in the ambulance. You do it right there, and you either call them, you either pronounce them, or you get a heartbeat back and you take them to the hospital.
We're going to take our final break.
Why wasn't he announced?
Oh, okay. No, go ahead. Never mind. We're not.
Yeah. Why wasn't he pronounced dead? Until later that evening in the hospital, if he was in this dire condition on the roadway and en route to the hospital.
Well, there has to be resuscitative measures that have to be taken before you pronounce somebody. You don't just because just because they're in cardiopulmonary arrest doesn't mean that we're just, okay, we're done with you. You know, like we want it, that's what CPR is for, is to try and get that heartbeat back. So what happened is, they did their measures in the ambulance and then they took them to the hospital, and the hospital has their measures that they have to take to try and get that heartbeat back. And then, once they've tried all that stuff, if they're still not able to get a heartbeat back, then they will make the call.
Okay, so I have a couple of non-medical related questions, Kevin, with regards to this trial. And one is the fact that Derek Chauvin's wife filed for divorce. And I see that she
she did it before, and then I see she did it after the death of George Floyd. And the fact that they've been saying that, I guess, whatever supporter that was supposed to have been on his side, his chair has been basically empty during the trial. What type of impact does that have for people watching in the courtroom, particularly
well,
the jurors?
I'll take the last issue first. I don't know who that person was who came in the courtroom, who sat there. And you, if you notice throughout the trial, that chair had been removed because no one at all came to support him, be it friend or family member. And so I think the jury might take away that maybe the defense knows that they're in major trouble, and now someone's coming to give them some type of moral support while, you know, the Titanic is sinking.
So, like, just sit there and look like you're concerned, right?
Like a concern. To humanize him, to show that, like, you know, there's somebody on his side. Because as you recall, the state had what's known as spark of life testimony in the form of George Floyd's brother, which is unique in Minnesota, that sort of humanizes a victim. And it allows the jury to understand what was important in that person's life before they died or before they were victimized. And so maybe that was a move to counter the potential impact of that particular testimony on a juror by bringing a family member in to sit with Mr. Chauvin as well. With respect to the divorce move, the pundits state that that was a maneuver to protect assets. Assets that were transferred, like, in its entirety. My understanding is that in that particular divorce, the settlement that was presented to the court transferred 100% of his entire assets to her in a divorce proceeding that presumptively would protect whatever he owned from being taken away in a judgment that was forthcoming. So, and I understand the court rejected that particular settlement. So, you know, that's my take on the divorce. So is he really getting a divorce? Probably. But I don't know that, you know, at this moment, what we're seeing is what would have happened but for his arrest and prosecution.
Okay. Yeah, I was just curious in terms of what kind of impact that might have. All right, so prosecution is done. For the moment, defense turn now. What are we expecting?
I think you scramble. I think you scramble to erase and to take the minds of the jurors off of this devastating medical testimony. This testimony was devastating. I think that the case at this point is going to rise and fall with the medical testimony. Everyone is of the belief that the force was unnecessary and that it was so excessive until there is no chance of anyone sanctioning what took place. So now you have to minimize or to mitigate what that force has caused by addressing the possibility of the force being a contributing but not a substantial factor resulting in Mr. Floyd's death. I hope Mr. Nelson has, you know, more personnel than that young lady sitting behind him at that table who are waiting in the wings to help him. And I hope he has a cadre of medical witnesses who are just as strong, who are going to come in and contradict the pulmonologist, the toxicologist, the cardiologist, and, you know, and any other medical expert that is waiting to come back in rebuttal.
I think the only thing
he
can...
Oh, I'm sorry. Good. I'm glad you're talking.
I think the only thing that he really has that he... or and kind of going back to your question of what he needs to bring out is that the autopsy findings don't, you know, identify... They don't identify truly the findings are not... there's no findings consistent with hypoxia. So I think that he died of hypoxia, but was the, and this is kind of going to the question you asked me prior to the show, Gretchen, is that, you know, the fentanyl versus the mechanical hypoxia, is, you know, does fentanyl result in hypoxia? It potentially can. Does the mechanical result in hypoxia? It potentially can. The bottom line is the autopsy findings are going to be exactly the same. There's nothing that you can look at on autopsy that identifies the hypoxic, the damage that was done due to the hypoxia.
Okay. Yeah, because I was just curious. I'm like, okay, you bring in medical experts. What can they say? How can they say anything that is going to go against what's already been presented that's going to make things look any better? Plus, my question to Kevin is Derek Chauvin taking the stand in his own defense? Should he take the stand in his own defense?
Oh,
I mean, could he say
it's
something?
The question of the hour.
Yep.
I am risky. And I generally will advise my clients to strongly consider doing something in the trial, which is audible, because the jury wants to hear from you. And reasonable people would deny or would at least explain why they didn't do what you've accused them of doing, especially where the consequences are so great. What do you have to lose? At this point, in terms of the pressure that was testified about that resulted in Mr. Floyd not being able to breathe. You know, if I were on the defense, I would strongly consider putting Mr. Chauvin up to talk about exactly what my body weight was and what was on my mind with respect to my knee being on the shoulder blade versus the neck. Because if you remember, Dr. Tolbin stated that Chauvin was in a near vertical position with his toes off of the ground at one point,
mm-hmm.
shifting his entire weight almost onto George Floyd. And, you know, one of the causes of death is, you know, the fact that, you know, this compression, you know, was a problem that resulted in oxygen not being able to freely flow, you know, through the body. So I probably would put Chauvin up just to kind of say, look, no, that wasn't the case, you know, or something to counteract that testimony. That was deadly testimony.
So, I mean, is from what you can tell, does he have the type of demeanor that would encourage any type of sympathy for him, any type of second thought towards him? In terms of, well, you know, he might have been fearful for his life or whatever other rationale may be going on there. Does he have that type of demeanor that is going to draw that type of reaction for him in his favor?
Well, at this time, we have created a monster in everyone's minds. Everyone thinks that Chauvin is like the Tasmanian devil. We haven't heard one word from his mouth. So I would try to humanize my client so that they could hear his voice. They could kind of like see his demeanor and his deportment and get some idea, which would be opposite of how we have envisioned this beast in our minds. So don't forget, he's a police officer who has testified before. Police officers are professional witnesses. These guys are like the masters of, and then what happened next, and how'd that make you feel, and what happened next. And they just go. You just wind them up, man, and they tear it up, man. You don't even have to prep them. So Chauvin knows how to testify. You know, keep that in mind.
Tara, any last opinion in terms of medical testimony, what's going to happen, what's going to make or break things?
You know, I think not really. I mean, I think that the testimony that's been given from the medical standpoint so far was very strong. I do think that that Dr. Baker, who did the autopsy himself, ended up appearing pretty biased. I think that Mr. Nelson did a good job of kind of, you know, ripping apart his testimony, and he kept avoiding questions or hedging questions that he really should have known the answer to. And I think that's another place where that nurse is going to come in and say, you know, he knew the answer to those and he didn't want to answer those questions.
Tara Gaday, thank you so much. Hopefully you'll come back, you know, if it, whether it's this case or another case, and give us some insight. Really appreciate it. Kevin Anderson, Mr. Anderson, thank you so much again for joining us. Really appreciate your insight. You all be well.
Thank you.
And thank you all for listening. This has been G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. Be well, be safe, be blessed, and please remember, all real power comes from God. Take care.
Make it all right. God is able.
God is able.
Whatever you need.
Whatever you need.
He'll supply.
He'll supply.
Whatever is broken.
Whatever is broken.
He can fix it.
He can fix it.
No need to worry.
No need to worry.
He's alive.
He's alive.
Whole church, he'll make it all right.
Make
it
easy.